I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Is college still a smart investment? Is rhetoric about the danger of student loans overblown? Student loan debt now totals more than $1.2 trillion, according to the New York Federal Reserve. That's more than auto loans and credit card balances. Beth Akers, an expert on the economics of higher education with the Brookings Institution, explains what's driving up college costs and why households carrying student debt are not, actually, worse off economically than households without this burden. Still, do you feel buried under student loans? Nina Heck, Director of Counseling and Client Relations for GuideWell Financial Solutions, demystifies repayment options and offers strategies to square away your finances. That's Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you have joined us. Today we're talking about higher education and student debt. Are the horror stories of college graduates buried under hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt skewing our perception of student loans? Is college still a sound investment? And for those struggling to climb out from underneath student loans, what are your options and what happens if you can't pay? In this hour, we'll look at the landscape of student loan debt in America, why tuition costs are increasing, and what you can do to limit your debt burden, and how to make informed decisions about the loans you take on. According to the Institute for College Access and Success, a nonpartisan organization that studies higher education policy, 7 out of 10 seniors who graduated from public and private nonprofit colleges in 2014 had student loans, and they averaged $28,950 per borrower. That's almost $29,000. In Maryland, 58% of graduates leave college with debt. That's about 6 out of 10, and their average burden is $27,457. Last month, the New York Federal Reserve reported that outstanding student loan balances have mounted to a whopping $1.2 trillion. Furthermore, more than 10% of aggregate student loan debt was delinquent by 90 or more days or actually in default in the last quarter of 2015. Student loan balances now surpass auto loan debt and credit card balances. Joining us to discuss all this is Beth Akers. Beth Akers is a fellow in the Brookings Institution's Center on Children and Families and a fellow at the Brown Center on Education Policy. She follows the economics of education with a focus on higher education policy. Beth Akers, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me today.
I'm very glad that you could be with us. With me here in Studio A is Nina Heck, Director of Counseling and Client Services for GuideWell Financial Solutions. GuideWell is a national nonprofit that offers free credit counseling, debt management, bankruptcy counseling, and financial education. Welcome back to Midday.
Thank you, Nina. Sheila. Thanks for having me.
Beth Akers, I gather from reading some of your research that you don't consider the student loan situation a crisis, which doesn't match at all what we tend to read and hear in the press. Where are you coming from on this?
Sure. So it's a bit of, you know, a language issue here, right? So do I think there's a macro crisis? The sky is falling. We need to bail out every person who has ever borrowed a dollar in student loans. No, I think the evidence just contradicts that notion entirely. But I do think there are real problems in higher education finance. There are certainly people who are struggling to make payments on their loans, and so I don't want to be dismissive of that notion. But it is the case that if you look at the numbers, the story is just not as bad on an overall level as people are making it out to be. And you know, we have seen debt increasing. We have more people borrowing. They're borrowing more. But if you look at the financials of these decisions that people are making in college, they're investing a large amount of money, but they're seeing an even bigger return in the long run. So if you think of it in the long run sense, these are people who are making really smart investments, borrowing at subsidized interest rates to do it, and in the long run are coming out better as a result. So it's important to keep that in mind when we think about these really big numbers that can seem really scary.
Yeah, I think we need to keep unpacking that during the course of this hour. Yeah. Because it is sort of counterintuitive. Nina Heck, tell me what you see in counseling, of who you're seeing and whether it seems like a crisis to you in the midst of working with these people.
Well, actually, Sheila, we see a little bit of both. We've actually had some of our consumers contact us, and their concerns are just about purchasing homes and they have student loan debt and they're concerned whether or not they're going to be able to make that. And they're thinking that maybe if they could reduce the payments on their student loans, it would allow them to have more money available, you know, for these big purchases. So they're in a position to pay their student loans. They're just trying to find ways to reduce the student loan payment. But on the other side of that, we're seeing many students who are contacting us really at the default stage, which is I wish we would see them sooner because obviously that would be a lot easier to work with.
When do they tend to come to you?
Well, we're getting when they're in default. We've had many of them come that the student loans are already defaulted. We've actually had some where their wages are garnished. We really see an array. We see ones that are just concerned because their student loans are already in deferment and they realize they don't have a position that's going to be able to support what the payments are when they come out.
We're going to loop back to your point about borrowers looking for ways to pay less. But let me ask Beth Akers. It is the case, is it not, that people repaying student debts are repaying over more years than was true a few decades ago?
Yeah, so when we look at the evidence on this, the repayment period has been extended significantly over the past two decades. Part of that's because people are taking out more debt, but a bigger reason for it is that we've had a change in policy that has allowed consumers to refinance or consolidate their federal student loans into terms that have longer repayment periods. And, you know, as an economist, this makes a lot of sense because, you know, we're
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Sure. As an economist, you know, this makes sense to me because, you know, people object to a longer repayment period because it, you know, imposes a financial burden on an individual for a longer period of time. But another way of thinking about it is that a college degree is something that pays off over the course of a lifetime. And so something that gives us benefit over the course of a lifetime doesn't necessarily need to be paid for in just a few short years, right? So there's some logic behind extending the period of time that that a person can pay off their debt, you know, as long as it's a reasonable debt and based on a strong investment.
You say, Beth Akers, a college degree pays off over a lifetime. How much? What do you as an economist see as the return on that investment?
Sure. So, I mean, I should say this is something that's really hard to measure, right? Because in order to do it properly, we'd like to have a crystal ball. We'd like to look into the future of the people who are getting college degrees today and know what their futures are going to look like compared to what they would have looked like if they hadn't gone to college, right? So any estimates that we have are just that. They're estimates. But the best ones that I've seen are estimating that the financial return on a bachelor's degree is about 15%. So if you think of an education as an investment, like you would think of putting money into the stock market or something, a 15% rate of return is actually pretty huge, right?
So you're basically saying that over the course of years, someone with a college degree on average is going to make 15% more than someone without?
That's a slightly different number. So the 15% is... You think about if a college degree costs you $100,000, for instance, and of course that price tag is going to depend on a lot of things, mostly on where you go, if it's a public or private sector institution. But if you think of the alternative for those dollars is investing them in the stock market, for instance, right? There's a particular rate of return. Maybe if you're in the S&P 500, you're getting about 7%. The return in terms of heightened future rate wages that you get from having a college degree on that initial investment is estimated to be about 15%.
That's Beth Akers, a fellow at the Brookings Institution and the Brown Center on Education Policy, here with us on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with me here in the studio is Nina Heck, who is chief of, I'm looking, Nina, for your title. Why don't you just jump in?
Director of Counseling and Client Services.
Director of Counseling and Client Services for GuideWell Financial Solutions. And you can be part of this conversation. What is your experience? Has student loan debt affected your ability to make other purchases, such as a car or a house? Are you worried that you'll be paying down your debt for the next two or three decades? Join the conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Nina Heck, let me turn to you with that information from Beth Akers about the return on the investment in college education. I'm sure many of the people you see are feeling at the point that they turn to you that it hasn't been a good investment.
So, you know, some of what we see are parents that are co-signed on loans with their children, and the children are struggling, having the ability to secure a position that'll be able to repay those loans. And so the parents are finding that they're having to repay it. So the effect is not only on the student, but it's also, you know, compounding with the parents having this burden and probably have other children that are ready to go to college. So they're, you know, caught in between trying to help one and still others that need to go. I have to say, most times when people reach out to a nonprofit such as ours, they are experiencing trouble. So we're seeing the other side of what Beth is seeing, more than likely because they're reaching out because they know they don't have a means to pay it, or they're short and their budgets are short. And so they're really concerned as to whether buying a home or purchasing that new car is going to be something they can, you know, see themselves doing.
How much of it, would you say, is the situation of someone who took out the loan but didn't get the degree? In other words, someone who has left school without getting a certificate or a degree?
Well, I think, and Beth probably can chime in on this as well, but I know that statistics show that people that have lower student loan debt, like $10,000 or less, are more likely to be the ones that default. And a lot of that's prompted because they do leave school, possibly because they were involved in a for-profit school, maybe a certificate program, and predominantly private loans. And once they get into a couple of semesters, they realize they can't afford to continue. So they end up dropping out. So there, you know, we have seen some of that, especially in the Baltimore City area. So we feel very, our concern is to reach out to these students and make sure that they have the proper education prior to getting involved in student loan debt.
Yeah, Beth, chime in. As Nina suggested, I have read that it is borrowers with lower balances who seem to be in the most trouble.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we've seen that through a lot of different studies that have been published over the past few years, and it's in some of my own work as well. It's definitely these folks who have very small balances who are the most likely to be defaulting on their student loans, but also most likely to just be reporting financial distress in general. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think this gets us to hone in a little bit closer on what the real problem is here and, you know, moves away from the rhetoric about student debt being this sort of global crisis and more onto the detail that it's the people who make these investments that don't see the return that we should be concerned the most about, right? And as you said, a lot of those people, a lot of those are going to be people who started college and didn't finish, or it's going to be people who paid for programs that had no history of producing good results for their students, or, you know, other things like that. So, again, dismissive of the macro notion of a student lending crisis, only for the purpose of allowing us to hone in on these problems, just like these.
I'm sure we will hear from some people who are in that situation. We are already hearing from some other people, and I'd like to talk to Sheila and have her degree. Sheila, welcome to Midday.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Yes, hi. I have two questions. I'm going to ask the easiest one, I guess, hopefully first, and that is, what happens when the person dies? What are the requirements associated with that? What I mean, which leads into my second question, is my difficulty is more, I think you started to speak of it earlier, is that I am involved in the parent plus loan situation where I signed off on, so to speak, my daughter's loans. And I'm finding at my age now of 56, looking at retirement, I have just resigned myself to the reality that I will die with this burden. I'm actually a master's level therapist, a graduate from Loyola here in Maryland, and I'm a therapist, mental health therapist, and I've never made over $55,000 a year. So I have tried to pursue. So my second question is there an agency outside of the servicing organization? I deal with American Education Services, for example, that I can call to talk to about these parent plus loans and try to get these payments down. I'm paying probably $600 a month now.
Okay, Sheila, we're getting close to needing to take a break. Let me ask Nina to address your first question and then hang with us through the break and we'll try to get to the second question. Parent plus loans. She thinks she's going to die with this loan.
Yes,
unpaid.
So there is a death discharge that's available if a person signed on the loan does pass away. I hope that's not the case. But, you know, the other thing that I would suggest, Sheila, is maybe give us a call. We can certainly look at there's some opportunities possibly with an income contingent repayment or an income sensitive repayment program that may be able to help with the Parent PLUS loans. I'm not sure, you know, exactly what you have, but we can certainly take a look at it. And one of the things we find is really just taking a look at how much income's available, you know, and what the person has in order to be able to meet the payments.
And your phone number, which we will put on our website,
is 877-222-7435.
877-222-7435. As I said, we will put that on our website. And we do need to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to continue on this topic with Beth Akers of the Brookings Institution Center for Children and Families and Nina Heck, Director of Counseling and Client Services for the nonprofit GuideWell Financial Solutions. Do you feel that your student loan debt was worth the cost? Did you research salary or employment information before deciding where to go to college and what to study? Join this conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Student loan debt in the U.S. now tops $1.2 trillion. Are you one of the 40 million Americans paying off student loans? Did you approach your decision to take on loans as an investment in your future? Do you worry each month about whether you'll be able to make your payment? You can be part of this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I am here with in the studio with Nina Heck, Director of Counseling and Client Services for the nonprofit GuideWell Financial Solutions, and with Beth Akers is joining us by phone from Washington. She's a fellow at the Brookings Institution's Center on Children and Families, as well as a fellow at the Brown Center on Education Policy. Beth, I was struck in your research that many freshmen, just having taken out their first loan, still are not aware that they have any debt. Explain that.
Yeah, so this is something that was really startling to me as well. So in working with some institutions on some experiments that we're doing to try to understand what's happening here, one of the things that was conveyed to us from financial aid officers was that their students just really didn't have a sense of how much they were taking on in debt. And so we decided to do some work to actually measure that on a national level. And what we found was exactly what you just said, is that when we interview them in the spring of their freshman year, so shortly after they've signed that first promissory note, we ask them how much they have in student loan debt. They just don't know, and they're off by a pretty wide margin, and they're underestimating what their burden is. Even scarier than that is that a lot of the students who we know have taken out federal student loans report to us that they don't have any debt at all. So it's very concerning, you know, to know that people are this unaware of what their financial position is regarding their college finances. You know, but I think it also sheds some light on why we have such a panic state around around student loans, because you can imagine someone completing their undergraduate studies and getting that first bill in the mail without anticipating what that burden is going to be, having some pretty negative feelings towards it. And I think that's part of what's happening today.
It is hard for me, as someone who graduated in the era when there wasn't such widespread student debt. I would think that signing that note would be such an eye-opening experience. It's very hard for me to put myself in the mindset of a young person who just isn't worried, isn't even aware that there's a debt overhang. Nina Heck, what do you encounter?
We see the same thing, Sheila. Actually, we've had, you know, when the consumer contacts us and they're struggling with the student loans, one of the things we have them do is go to the website to download their federal student loans so we can see what all they do have, and private loans as well. Oftentimes, they don't have the information available. When it comes to private loans, they're not even sure what they have. So we're looking up the websites and the phone numbers for them to try to find the information. They just know they're not paying them and haven't paid them, but they're really not even aware of who they owe or where they're at this point.
Would they be getting written payment notices?
One would think so. One would think so. You know, and I know I put two girls through college, and one of the things that we started out with was keeping folders and keeping all the information together so we had it in a place that we would be able to look back on should there be a problem. But that's really it's necessary because, especially private loans, there's different agreements that are available or things that they would consider to do if the person becomes unavailable to pay, but it's in that promissory note.
Since you have raised it, this is probably a good time for me to ask you to tell us what is the important distinction between a federal loan and a private loan?
So the federal loans, there's a lot more room for negotiation when you're in trouble making your payments. There's a lot of different programs available. They have loan forgiveness programs for like teacher loan forgiveness. There's public service loan forgiveness if you work in the public sector. There's, you know, abilities to defer and have forbearance. Repayment plans, as Beth was talking about, extending them out. I have to laugh. We had a client that was in our program that actually contacted us to let us know at 72 she'd made the last payment on her student loan for a master's program, and she was so excited. So, yes, they do extend into the latter years. But the private loans, of course, there's not as much flexibility if you become if you're in a position where you're not able to make the payments. But those promissory notes really hold the key to what that particular lender has available.
I'm not sure I understood that. The promissory notes hold the key to what the lender has available.
For the private lenders. So there's not this generic, you know, you can go to them and they all do this. Each lender has a different set of principles and rules that they will allow should you become unemployed or because of health reasons you're no longer able to make the payment. Usually there's information in those promissory notes that will tell us what that particular lender.
The actual terminology
yes.
of the note. Beth Akers, I assume that your research and probably the numbers you've heard me throwing out include both the federal loans and private loans?
Yeah. I mean, so we have different numbers as part of the conversations, but the one that I was citing earlier is coming from the combination of both private and federal loans.
We've got, as I said, lots of people want to be part of this conversation. Let's talk to Lily in Baltimore. Lily, welcome to Midday.
Hi. Hi, yes. I called in. My husband and I are both in our early 30s. I went back to school for a nursing bachelor's degree. My second bachelor's a few years ago, and at this point, between the two of us, we both have steady jobs with good incomes. We pay over $1,000 a month, much over, in loan payments, and we're at the point where we aren't even sure when we'll be able to buy a home or have kids because the amount of money going towards our loans every month feels overwhelming. And we're both educated people. We know our options. But we don't qualify for a lot of income base because we're married and we both do have good jobs.
And Lily, before I ask our guests to address your situation, would you and your husband say that going back to school was a good investment?
So I would. I'm really glad I went back to get my nursing degree. In retrospect, as you were talking about earlier, the kind of bill that I looked at before I graduated seemed almost like make-believe money, and then when I had to actually start paying it back, it became a lot more real. And again, I wasn't a naive 18-year-old. I was in my mid-20s. My husband, I think, would have a different answer maybe because he took out his loans when he was still pretty young and didn't really understand what he was doing. And his loans they're all federal loans, but they've gone through multiple, companies. Danny Mae, they've gone through the ringer. He probably couldn't even tell you who holds all of them at this point. So I'm not sure that he would say the same thing.
Lily, I appreciate the call. Nina, you're nodding your head vigorously as you're listening to Lily tell her story.
We hear this a lot, and I think the key to this particular scenario is the budget. And I'm not saying that Lily and her husband don't have one, but it's really vital that you have a strong budget so that you know how much income you're working with each and every month and you know where the money's going out for your household expenses, because without a plan of being able to see an end, it feels very overwhelming. So I think the budget is really the key to making sure that you know that you have your bases covered. You're hopefully setting up an emergency savings. You know, you have some money set aside for possibly considerations of a home in the future, or else you can see that the loans, by paying extra and eliminating the process of elimination, that you know at some point you will be in a position to move forward with that. But it's really the budgeting.
Beth Akers, what is the big picture to an economist of whether or not paying off student loans is crowding out other kinds of investment, like the kinds of things that young people often do after college, buying a house, having kids. Are these things being deferred in a big way?
You know, the evidence is actually uncertain at this point about whether or not that's true. You know, economists tend to think of the world in very black and white terms. So we want to look at this problem and say, well, if folks are investing money and getting good return on that money, they're better off in the long run, they have more wealth over the course of their lifetime, then in theory they have more to spend on, you know, raising a family, buying a house, buying cars, and all those things like that that contribute to economic productivity and our gross GDP. But I think the question that's left unanswered is, how is the distress that our borrowers are feeling affecting their economic and financial decision making? And that's something it's really difficult to measure in the data. But you know, you can hear it in even your callers' voices that clearly there's a lot of distress over this issue, and it's really yet to be seen how that's going to affect spending patterns, if it's going to cause our young people to be delaying these transitions to adulthood or the activities that we tend to associate with the transition to adulthood. But it's sort of a time will tell sort of thing.
That is Beth Akers, an expert on higher education and finance here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. With me here in the studio is Nina Heck, who is director of counseling and client services for the nonprofit GuideWell Financial Solutions. We're taking calls about student loans. Our phone number is 410-662-8780. Our email is midday at wypr.org. We got an email from Jen in Baltimore, who says in part, I would love to go back in time and tell my younger self to work through college and pay as I went. Also, I would recommend that this younger self change a major to something that had a higher return on the investment. Paying $22,000 a year for an English degree was foolhardy. That's from Jen in Baltimore. Beth Akers, what do you think when you hear that?
I mean, that really resonates with me, and it brings me back to a comment that Lily made, actually, when she called in briefly, where she said the money that she saw on the bill when she thought about going to college was almost like make-believe money, and the money that she's spending each month to repay those debts, it's certainly not feeling like make-believe money to her. And so I think there's a disconnect with the way that we talk about college in this country. We've talked for a long time about how it's just this sort of golden ticket to economic prosperity, to the middle class, to a good life, and that's caused students to make decisions about college rather blindly. You know, they don't know this information about how much they're borrowing. They're not thinking critically about, you know, how to spend dollars on the front end, whether or not to pursue certain majors or not, and that does a disservice to them in the long run. You know, I think that a lot of folks would like to think that education is this thing that we should be able to experience and experience in any way we'd like, and unfortunately, that's not the financial reality for a lot of students, and not talking about it in that way is really a disservice to them.
Thank you. Jessica in Baltimore is calling us. Jessica, welcome to Midday.
Hi. Thank you for having me, Sheila. Thank you, guests.
Sure.
So I entered college in 2004, and I very much relate to the previous caller and the kind of disillusionment that we all were kind of taught in not realizing that those were real dollars that we were financing. But luckily I made it through and I finished my undergrad with close to $35,000 in debt. And recently I bought a home and I found out through my lender that because I was in debt of over $20,000 in student loans, both private and federal loans, I actually qualified for incentives in financing my mortgage. I got a lower APR rate. I also got some money toward closing. And maybe this could end up ultimately being that predatory financing that we all became trapped in years ago. My student debt has actually helped me make those larger commitments later in life that do come after college.
That surprises me, Jessica. I'm glad you shared that story. Nina, tell us more about what options people have when they're faced with a fairly big burden like $35,000 and the desire to make some other investments in their life.
Well, again, Sheila, I think we pride ourselves on the fact that we consider holistic counseling, where we're looking at the person's income in the budget. Oftentimes, people that are you know, struggling with student loans, reach out to for-profit organizations for help that only really look at one loan or the loan they're having trouble with and come up with a repayment plan. Whereas we take a look to make sure that the person has sufficient income to manage their budget before they start looking at the student loan debt that they have. But again, I think, you know, the war is won in preparation by having their self in a position where they know what they're up against, knowing who they owe, what type of payments they are able to make. And, you know, if they need help, knowing what's available to them if they find themselves in a position where they can't meet the 10-year standard repayments.
Well, you made clear earlier that there are lots of different setups for private loans, and it's you can't generalize about what kind of renegotiation might be available. But Jessica said she got a lower APR rate on her mortgage because of her student loan. Is there a way to negotiate a lower interest rate on your student loans? What kind of interest rates are most people paying, and can you get that down?
It really varies, but what again, what you're looking for when you're looking at the different programs that are available, there's IBRs, there's the pay program, there's the repay program that came out in December. And a lot of these, you're looking at the, you know, the interest rate hopefully being lower than what you have. But more the benefit is that they're extending the loan out longer, and that allows the payment to be less. And therefore, it becomes more, you know, possible for the consumer to meet the payment if they're in a position where they can't make the payment. So again, I think that's key as well. If you can really make the payment, you need, you know, getting that completed in 10 years is wonderful. But if you can't, then there are programs available. And again, it's just a matter of knowing which ones. And that's where we got involved with the student loan counseling, because all the information is on the U.S. Department of Education, but it is really bogged down into just tons and tons of information where people just get to the point where they don't know what to do. So we feel that reaching out, you know, to an organization that can help them maneuver that is helpful.
And I would like to repeat again that the phone number for GuideWell, if you feel you need to reach out to them, 877-222-7435, 877-222-7435, and we will have that number on the midday page at wypr.org. Beth Akers, what are your thoughts about stretching out loan payments or trying to figure out a way to pay more, even if it means putting off some other investments like a home that you'd like to make?
You know, I think it's going to come down to the individual consumer and what their preferences are. So some folks are going to feel like this debt is a weight on them and an emotional burden, and so they may choose to you know pay it down more quickly. Not everyone has that luxury, and I wish that we would not make people feel bad if that's not the position that they're in, because it, you know, as I said before, since it's an investment that pays off over the course of your lifetime, it's not unreasonable, at least in my opinion, that people could think about paying for it over the course of their lifetime, which would make it a much more affordable proposition for a lot of people.
Okay, we're going to take another quick break here and continue our conversation when we get back with Beth Akers, a fellow in the Brookings Institution's Center on Children and Families and a fellow at the Brown Center on Education Policy, and with Nina Heck, Director of Counseling and Client Services for the nonprofit GuideWell Financial Solutions, and with your calls. Is your child headed off to college in the fall? What plans do you have to keep the cost affordable? Are you encouraging your child to attend community college or an in-state school in order to save money? Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or call us 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Are student loan repayments part of your monthly budget? You are not alone. More than 40 million Americans are paying off student loans. I'm speaking today with Nina Heck, Director of Counseling and Client Services for the nonprofit GuideWell Financial Solutions, and Beth Akers, a fellow at the Brookings Institution Center on Children and Families. Join our conversation. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. Richard from Mount Airy has a comment. Richard, welcome to the show. Hello, Richard.
Hello.
Richard, you're on the air. What is your comment?
Okay. I used to work at a private proprietary school, a trade school, a until I figured out what was going on, and I eventually quit. We were actually promising these people futures for various trades that was absolutely fraudulent. It took me a while to figure it out. Many of those companies have been subsequently put out of business. One of them has now become actually called TESS, which is part of the Kaplan organization. What about those students who are stuck with these loans when they were fraudulently enrolled in these schools by giving really outlandish promises of what their future would be?
And as far as you know, Richard, there hasn't been a legal action against your former employer?
Well, there has been some comment, and then because in the case of that school, I suspect they're so politically well-connected that nothing happened. But I'll give you a couple of other schools.
Let me ask our guests about it. Richard, thank you for the call. Beth Akers, how big a part of the whole picture are these for-profit schools and the promises of jobs that don't materialize?
Yeah, so they're not a huge part of the market today, but the concern is that they're growing. And I'll say, you know, we like to pick on for-profit institutions, and I'll say that what we want to be talking about is institutions that don't produce results for students. There are for-profit institutions that do that. There are non-for-profit institutions that do that. The problem is, how do you get these bad actors out of the market so that people don't incur debts in order to, you know, go through a program that is not likely to produce a good result for them? And then also on the back end, you know, what's the solution? And it is the case that if there's fraud in terms of what the institution represents to be providing to the student, and the student does not have a liability. Maybe Nina can talk more about that too. But it's a big problem. I mean, it's essentially, how do we create more accountability for these institutions who are receiving a tremendous amount of taxpayer support through grants and subsidies to make sure that students aren't put into this position of getting into a bad financial position.
Nina Heck from Guidewell Financial Solutions, what kind of research can a student and her family do to check it out, to minimize the risk of getting into a situation where they're taking out a loan for a degree that's not going to be worth it, or that a degree they may not be able to hang in to get?
Well, actually, Sheila, you know, when this caller was talking about this, I remember, for example, last year there was Corinthian College, colleges, which Beth probably heard as well being in Washington, but they were actually found, you know, guilty and shut down, and there was loan forgiveness because they were placing statements that said there was 100% job placement upon completing school. So, you know, those students were given loan forgiveness in just that very situation. So I hope with Richard that the schools he's talking about, that somebody's, you know, looking into that as well when it's fraudulently stated. But, you know, you really just have to do your homework and look at the degree that you're looking into and determine whether or not it's a degree that's feasible to pay back the amount of debt that you're taking out. Oftentimes we counseled some students in different states that went for different degrees that in that particular state they were not going to have the earning potential to repay their loan, but they could if they would consider moving to other areas. So you really just need to make sure that, you know, when you're it is a large investment, so making sure that what you're moving into, you will have the ability to repay it when it comes time.
Beth Akers, in your view, what is the best way to do the kind of homework that Nina Heck just mentioned? I'm sure some people feel just at sea trying to make a decision about how this school is going to work out, how this mm-hmm. degree is going to work out.
Absolutely. So there's a good reason for that, and that's that historically you were basically taking a shot in the dark when you were choosing a school because there just wasn't the data available for consumers to take a look and see, have students who attended this college fared well after they graduated? And only recently has Department of Education and the White House released that data. There's a new website, which is not hugely consumer-friendly, but it might be a starting point. It's called the College Scorecard. It's on the White House webpage. And what it does is it gives graduation rates by institution. It gives earnings for people who attended all the different institutions that are in the federal financial aid program. And I believe it gives employment rates, although I'm not sure about that one. But I think what we're going to see happen is that the ranking systems that are have been prominent in the college discussions are going to start to take this information into account. And you know, if I were a consumer, I'd be looking closely at what rankings are available for me to take a look at, and which ones are taking these employment outcomes into account. And that's going to be a growing area because, as I said, this data was just released, and I think that the marketplace is really still learning how to make best use of it. And unfortunately for consumers, it's not hugely consumer-friendly right now, but the information at least is there if you look for it.
Yeah, the easiest way, I think, to find it is just to search White House and College Scorecard. The actual website is College Scorecard. All one word, collegescorecard.ed.gov, and we will link to that from the midday page at WYPR. Let us talk to Vince, who's in the Washington suburbs. Vince, welcome to Midday. Vince,
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you, and what sounds like a waterfall behind you. So maybe you can make your comment fairly concise.
Okay, my wife and I have one child. I'm getting ready to go off to school, and we have a lot of debt, but we both, you know, have good jobs and are paid well. My plan was to defer most of the college tuition and then use the four-year period of time to pay off our revolving debt, and then, you know, we'll be in a better position to pick up her student loans. I just don't see her being in this economy, even in 4 years, her being able to take on the sizable debt. She was accepted at University of Ohio of Miami. You know, it's $48,000 a year, and we applied for some grants. But I just wanted to ask your panel what they thought of that strategy. Get their comments. So I'll take that off the chat. Thanks.
Vince, I appreciate your calling. Beth Akers, what about that? I know your research has found that people are more likely, families are more likely to turn to student loans than they were a few decades ago as the first option for financing college. Does Vince's idea of getting rid of revolving debt and relying on student loans to get over this period make sense to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's going to depend on what financing options are available to any given person. And in this case, you know, obviously interest rates on federal student loans are low relative to what people are going to be paying on credit cards or personal loans or, you know, whatever other sources of financing they might have. And so the question is, you know, when you're thinking of whether or not to pay down this debt more quickly than you need to, or deferring it as long as you can, the question is, where else could you be putting that money, right? If it's paying down a high-interest credit card, then I think all the experts would suggest that you should do that first. You know, people should also think about what are their other revenue opportunities with their money. If they have an employer who has a 401k matching program and they could be putting that money into that and getting a match instead of paying down their student loan, that might be a wise decision too. So I think just paying it off right off the bat is not always the right solution for these families. And probably Nina has some thoughts on that too.
Yeah, Nina.
I definitely agree with Vince's plan. I think paying down the credit card, because you are going to have the higher interest on those credit card debts. So that makes a lot of sense to go with that. Hopefully his daughter, you know, will obtain employment and be in a position to be able to repay some of this, so the burden won't be solely theirs. But I think that's an excellent plan, but also making sure, again, that they have their savings and their 401 and attending to their other commitments as well.
Vince, I appreciate the call. We got an email from Marcia who raises a question that I would like you to address, Nina Heck. Marcia writes, I have a federal student loan I am now paying back by way of an income-based plan. And Marcia asks, why is it calculated using gross income? So tell us a little bit about income-based plans.
They do calculate against the adjusted gross income, and they use a percentage. It's usually 15%. And then they also compare that to the poverty level, 150% of poverty level guidelines.
I'm sorry, when you say they use 15%, in other words, they expect you to be paying into against your student loan debt 15% of your adjusted gross income.
They use the 15% of the adjusted gross income in the measurement tool to determine that, with the 150% poverty level, to determine how much income's available to pay on the repayment plan. So there's a calculator that's online that they can actually go into, and based upon plugging in those figures, it'll say what that actual payment would be based on those figures. So they'll use those.
So when Marcia says, why is it calculated using gross income, She's got a little wrong. It's adjusted gross.
It's adjusted gross income.
And what gets taken, what are the big items that get taken out of your gross income to reach that income level? The adjusted gross takes out what?
Well, you would have any of your exemptions that would have come out prior to that and anything that you could have taken off. When you do
the same
your taxes,
kinds of things, the same kinds you of things your, you that the federal government doesn't
yes,
tax you.
Yes, you would use that figure when you're doing your tax returns.
Mm-hmm. Beth Akers, it seems to me that I read in some of your writings that you think income based plans are a good way to go, a good way to try to pay back your student loans.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I have talked a lot about how I think the returns to education are positive, and therefore she may not be so concerned about this macro crisis. But the real problem is risk. It's that education is an investment that pays off for some people and not for others. And income-based repayment or income-driven repayment type systems actually succeed in creating a really good safety net for borrowers to make sure that in any month they're not going to be facing in any period of time, I wouldn't say month to month, but in any period of time they're not going to be facing unaffordable payments. It's adjusted to their income, and there's federal programs that do that. There's an emerging private market for loan-type products that are based on income-driven repayment, and I think that's the way to go. I think we need to be talking about more about how to create safety nets like that and how to get people to be aware of those safety nets because, it's really advantageous for the students to be participating in those types of programs.
Nina, before we wrap up here in a few minutes, I want to go through just a couple of nuts and bolts. Can you negotiate when you're taking out a student loan? What kind of negotiating power, if any, do you have?
Well, they simply go through and they complete their FAFSA, and then what comes
the
back...
The financial disclosure form.
And then what will come back to them is what, based upon what they've, supplied the lenders, on their application, it'll come back and say what type of student loans that they're able to access, and again, I would always, if you can utilize as many of the federal and less of the private, because there is more negotiation for the federal loan product.
And when do student loans start coming due? As soon as you graduate?
The federal loans, there's typically a 6-month grace period. So the private loans can be different. Some of these I've seen where parents have co-signed and they come due as soon as the money's dispersed to the school. And again, that's in all that fine print that a lot of people don't bother to read. So when the bill comes in, they're just totally taken back. They had no idea. So you just really need to make sure that you understand what you're signing.
And if you get in a financial mess, can you discharge student loans in bankruptcy?
It's very difficult to do that. I mean, we've seen a couple of instances where a person, with verification of a total permanent disability was able to do that. But in most likelihood, you're going to still have the student loans to repay.
Beth Akers, we're down to like half minute or so. What is the thought that you would like listeners to take away from this conversation?
I think I'm going to think for people who are making a decision to go to college, be forward thinking about what your financials are going to look like and make sure that enrollment decision and all of your borrowing decisions are based on what you expect for your future, rather than just entering this decision blindly, because it obviously has huge impacts on lifelong finances.
I really appreciate this conversation. I want to thank you both. Beth Akers, a fellow at the Brookings Institution Center on Children and Families and a fellow at the Brown Center on Education Policy, and Nina Heck, Director of Counseling and Client Services for the nonprofit GuideWell Financial Solutions. Their phone number is 877-222-7435. I also want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Unique sandwiches, salads, specials each day, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. And thank you for listening. I hope you'll be back with us tomorrow. We're going to examine a growing threat to public health. At least 23,000 people die each year from infections resistant to antibiotics. We're going to look at why. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.